about all Americans come from somewhere else. We think of ourselves, in fact, we call ourselves a nation of immigrants. Just who we are when we say we, and who we're thinking about when we say they, and what America is, these are some part of the subject of this edition of Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. With us on this edition is Ward Churchill. Ward Churchill is a professor, a prolific writer, a social critic, and a self-professed, unreconstructible indigenist. Welcome, and thanks for adding that phrase to my vocabulary.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me here.
Indeed. I want to start, if you will, let us do this, talking about words and what we mean by them. In Indians Are Us, your latest book put out in 1994, you said in a chapter that if I were to ask you what your tribal background is, and you were to ask me what my heritage is, we may be asking each other very different questions. And these questions are, and answers are, loaded by the value we place on the words. Can I ask you what you mean by the value of the words if we're talking about, let's say, tribe or heritage?
Well, I think the connotations that I was trying to get to there specifically do go to tribe. The reference there is always made with regard to Native people. In North America, obviously, North American Natives primarily, but also in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. Tribe being a signifier of a sort of primitive mode of existence or social organization, apparently, in the minds of those who ask the question. Now, primitive is a pejorative term in its own right, meaning somehow or another culturally and materially retarded. That's what it's intended to signify. But tribe in itself, while carrying that connotation, has another, because it refers not normally to human groupings, but rather to animal groupings. It's more akin like asking what herd or covey or flock you happen to belong to. It's never a term that is utilized to ask a European tourist, for example, the nature of their heritage. What tribe do you belong to? Mm-hmm. Okay, it's very specific in its orientation, and the connotations are, while to a certain extent sublimated, people are not necessarily conscious of the intent or the signification in addressing another person in this fashion. They're very much encrypted into that mode of discourse.
When we move these words back and forth between each other, unconscious of the coding, why doesn't the coding disappear? Why doesn't the weight disappear?
Well, because the coding or the weight was very consciously and intentionally applied originally. Mm-hmm. And so it continues to carry that force in an unstated way, but it's nonetheless there. Now, I say it was consciously and intentionally done, and I think the record of linguistic interaction between Native people in North America and the immigrant populations that came in and interacted with them is quite clear. With the United States, originally you find the documentary record that pertains to Indian-white relations utilizing a vernacular of nation to nation. The indigenous peoples are referred to as nations in exactly those terms. And over a period of time, you see an evolution as the nature of the power relationship changes. The evolution of the language goes to where there is the introduction of the term tribe in the official documents, and then after a while, say by the mid to two-thirds of the way through the 19th century, the tribe and nation are used sort of interchangeably, and then the weight shifts to using tribe more than nation. By 1903, in a lone wolf case, you see a rewriting of John Marshall's 1831 and 32 Cherokee decisions that are verbatim, with the exception that they have lifted out the word nation and inserted the word tribe, and tribe has been the currency of discourse with regard to Native people ever since. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of diminishing the status and the stature of Native people with a simple linguistic twist, a sort of linguistic sleight of hand. And the purpose of it has been consciously forgotten but more subconsciously the intent remains.
Still floats in the culture. Mm-hmm. This is Ward Churchill with us on Conversations. He's an associate professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and I mentioned earlier a prolific writer. We'll talk about some of his books. The most recent is Indians Are Us, with a question mark at the end. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. I asked you about the exchange on both sides, and I guess I want to bring that back. When you say tribe, do you mean nation? Do you mean peoples?
I tend not to use the word tribe other than where it is part of a specific title. Now, there are some native peoples, indigenous peoples, who refer to themselves or have been formally designated and thereby accepted the designator tribe. And where it is a formal title, I will utilize it. I make reference to tribal governments, usually having to do with those governments created by the federal government of the United States for Indian people, or imposed upon Indian people under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. Now, those were designated as tribal governments. They are not a specifically Indian thing, and therefore I will make the reference, tribal reference, to them. Mm-hmm. Okay, but when making reference to the people in their own right, I use nation or people, mm-hmm. not tribe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, I think I want to ask you about that now. I keep thinking about, when I was reading this chapter, I kept thinking about words, and then I was thinking about Ted Turner and Atlanta Braves and Washington Redskins and Cleveland Indians, and I forget what all else. There are a lot of people who just say, oh, for heaven's sakes. In this case, they say a name is a name, and it's not hurting anything. Tell me why that's not true.
Well, for the same reason that if we were to start a new franchise in Newark, New Jersey, and call it the Niggers, it would be offensive, rightly so, to a substantial portion of the U.S. population.
But nigger isn't the same as...
Redskin, for example.
Redskins.
Redskin and nigger, I would say, would be essentially equivalent terms. Uh-huh. If you think it's cute and just good, clean fun to make reference to Native people as Redskins in the nomenclature of a professional football team in the nation's capital, then I would suggest that there would be, by that definition, nothing wrong with calling a Newark team the Niggers, mm-hmm. okay, or a Galveston team the Greasers, with reference to Mexican Americans or Mexican nationals. We could have teams called the Gooks. We could have, it doesn't need to be restricted to race and ethnicity, we could have the San Leandro Sluts and make sort of an honoring statement with regard to women.
Starts playing real rough, doesn't it, real quick?
Well, we're having fun. There's nothing, it's just a name.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is just a name. And I don't think if you make the analogy, if you were to slip that over and address it to another group, it would be quite clear that it's not just innocuous, and it's not just wholesome entertainment. It's not just a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? No right. more or no less so with regard to American Indians than with regard to any other identifiable group. The only thing is, you see this proliferation of sports team mascots in the naming of teams with regard to Native people in this sort of derogatory fashion, and not with regard to any other group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. This is, I think, has something to do with our cultural affection for parts of our heritage that have come through stereotyping. And I just want to pose that to you to see if that makes sense to you, that we have taken the nobility of Native Americans and attached it to things we want to endow with strength.
Well, I'm not sure that you could look at the caricature of the Indian that's Chief Wahoo for the Cleveland Indians, for example, and see that as any sort of a statement of nobility.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather akin to the sorts of portrayals that were done of Jewish people in Der Stürmer and other Nazi publications in the early 1930s. So
yeah,
the intent is not necessarily a positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
There may be instances where what is being said is true, that there was some sort of a misbegotten intent to honor Native people in the naming of certain sports teams, whether professional or university or public school system teams, whatever. But in a number of other cases, and I point again to the Cleveland Indians and the Chief Wahoo mascot that they utilize,
mm-hmm.
the naming of the Washington Redskins and so on, where there can be no question that there was ever an intent to do honor to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather to have one of those sick little racial belly laughs at the expense of a victimized group.
Okay.
Something at which America has excelled for a long time. You look at the history of Klan or Klan-oriented publications, basically white supremacist publications of the 19th century and the way they've carried over into the 20th, you find it's part of a very long stream. These are not isolated instances, and there's no reason why they cannot be properly understood. People who say they understand them in any other way than how I'm describing them here are either woefully ignorant of the history of their own country or intentionally trying to confuse the issue. Mm-hmm. I've got no time for them or their arguments in either event. Mm-hmm. It's an obfuscation.
Stanford University and some others have come around and said, oh, you're right, we don't want to be associated with this anymore. How mm-hmm. do you feel that this movement to enlighten and get some name changes happening for sports teams is coming?
Well, very unevenly. Stanford's a good example, because part of what was raised at Stanford at the time that they were considering making the name change were these stale old arguments about, well, the fans expect it, the fans like it, our revenues will drop off, no one will come to our games, the team will suffer, morale will suffer, blah, 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 none of which happened at Stanford. Mm-hmm. In fact, they won a couple of extra games the year after, which says something to team morale, I would suppose, and attendance at their games went up. So rather than being the Stanford Indians or the Stanford Crimson, and they're more successful. Not to mention the fact that they're conforming to what I would have to say would be minimum standards of social civility in the process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to laud them too much for doing something which was an obvious thing that anyone with any integrity would have done. I'm pleased that they measured up to these minimum standards of interaction in civil fashion with other people, but we needn't go on too much about them having made some exceptional step.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Optimistic about the other teams falling in line, or do you think this is a long-term battle with more underneath it?
I think it's a long-term, and it's one, for whatever reason, there is considerable emotional vestiture in the part of the public and some of the owners. Ted Turner, for example, who is married to Jane Fonda, who purports to be this very sensitive, enlightened, progressive individual, particularly with regard to the treatment of peoples of color and women, and so forth. I've been channeling money into Native projects to indicate that they have goodwill towards Native people, and adamantly refusing at the same time to change the name of the Atlanta Braves mm-hmm. or to abandon the tomahawk chop or these mm-hmm. rituals where buffoons go and paint themselves with grease paint in the face to be what they think an Indian in war paint, as they call it, would look like, and wear turkey feather headdresses and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. They persist in this. Now, this is 3 years after they were confronted on it, and all they've done is throw out some chump change to try to buy people off, to buy off the criticism mm-hmm. and insist on continuing with this practice of degrading Native people.
I want to ask you in just a moment about kind of the heritage of, the heritage of this in literature in just a second. This is Conversations. We're talking with Ward Churchill. He is Associate Professor of Communications at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He also holds the title at Boulder of the Coordinator of the American Indian Studies Program at the Center of Studies of Ethnicity and Race in America, located at UColorado, Boulder.
Quite a mouthful, isn't it?
It is. I was just thinking that. Thank you. His latest book is Indians Are Us. It came out of Common Courage Press. Before that, just in 1993, Struggle for the Land, Indigenous Resistance to Genocide, Ecocide, and Expropriation in Contemporary North America. The working title there, Struggle for the Land, also Common Courage Press. That came out in 1993. You have said in an article for the Journal of Ethnic Studies, and I expect in other places in your writing, that how we as Americans feel about Native Americans emerged through the literature as early as the earliest colonizers arrived, and that the kind of three images of Native Americans, of savage, of heathen, and of noble mm-hmm. savage, came out of the literature. Can you hark back and show us some instances of how that happened? What I'd like to do is kind of bring us forward to show how the literature stuck in the civilization.
Well, basically the overall theme there is that ever since the encounter between the Columbian, post-Columbian European and Native people began, the Europeans were always given to the proposition that they needed to portray Native people in various fashions in their reports, in their communications with one another, to portray Native people in a way that was of utility to them. It had nothing to do with trying to render an accurate reflection of what it was they were encountering, but rather what they needed the entity they were encountering to be in order to act or interact with it in various ways. Now, I suppose among the more spectacular is a very early one. I suppose within 5 years of the initial Columbian landfall, there were reports going back of encounters with Native people who had navels or eyes in their navels. Okay, mm-hmm. You have one-legged, one-footed Native people who apparently hopped around. They were strange and magical creatures, so different that one would not relate to them as human beings. And I think that's the key there. Not human beings, at least as human beings were understood by Europeans at the time. So there was this process of projecting Native people as something other than human that began at the onset. Now that can be something that's menacing and dangerous, mm-hmm. beastly, maybe vermin-like, and in need of destruction. That's one long channel.
So this would be the new white purpose in this new land.
That's one dimension of it.
Yes.
Now, in another dimension, you come out with this that you made reference to of a sort of noble savage. And that became an operant strain at almost the same time as this sort of like dangerous and menacing savage was brought or ushered into being on the printed page. A classic example of that, I suppose, in this country would be James Fenimore Cooper's depiction of both streams in his novels. Mm-hmm. You have noble savages, Chingachgook, for example, in The Last of the Mohicans, is a noble savage. But how is the nobility defined? This is straight out of British colonial literature. Nobility is defined for the savage in terms of their direct utility and degree of assimilation with white culture. Mm-hmm. So the Mohican is aligned with his white, who's aligned with other whites, and is of good service to them, and is in a way loyal to them, and is very effective as a fighter for them, by those definitions, a noble savage. On the other hand, you have, I'm blocking on the name, Magua.
Yes, the other fellow.
The other fellow, right. The other pole, okay. That evil, dirty savage type. And by definition, he is evil and dirty savage because he is fighting, first and foremost, as a Huron, as an Indian patriot, as a part of his culture. Mm-hmm. The greater the degree of identification with patriotism with regard to an indigenous culture, the more evil, the more beastly you become. So you got good Indians and bad Indians. Then the flow of dominant society discourse on the native, defined by the nature of the relationship to that society, not defined by the nature of their relationships to themselves, to the integrity of their traditions, or anything else that would mark sort of autonomous human existence. Mm-hmm. In neither case, and that was my point in that little study of colonialism and literature, in neither case is the reflection of Native reality accurate. It's a reflection of white fantasy, basically.
And when you mentioned The Last of the Mohicans, of course the book, the movie goes back to the book, but still that the movie allows us to move those images forward today. How seriously do you take that?
Well, we have the same thing operant not only in the pages of literature or depiction in film, but in actual policy implementation. You had in the United States a formal federal policy beginning in the late 19th century of compulsory assimilation of Native people. Good Indians in this society are defined as being those who are most closely approximating to white standards of perception, value, comprehension, and so forth. Bad Indians, those in need of things like welfare because their land and the basis of their subsistence has been taken away to fuel the dominant society's economy and so forth, are those who try to retain. Bad Indians are those who try to retain the linkages and practices of their own traditions, mm-hmm. to retain their own autonomy, their own dignity and integrity, the possibility of their own self-determination and sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So, sell out, basically, you're a good Indian. Resist, you're a bad Indian. Now, again, I think we can understand the function of this by way of analogy. This is equivalent of saying that those French, during the German occupation, who participated in the Vichy government, administering to their people on behalf of the Nazis, mm-hmm. were good Frenchmen. And de Gaulle and the Maquis, the partisan resistance and so forth, those are the bad French. Okay. The greater the degree of adherence to the needs of French culture in resistance to German occupation, the worse. The greater the degree of capitulation, the better. Mm-hmm. These are the definitions of the conqueror and the colonizer, pure and simple. It's easy to understand when it's the Germans against the French, but everyone purports to be confused about it when it's American Indians dominated by the United States. Oh. Just don't understand anymore. None of the normal rules of analysis apply for some strange reason.
In Indians R Us, you make this analysis regarding the concepts of genocide, that our understanding in America of genocide is mass immediate killing, and yet if we go back to World War II and the conclusions from in the United Nations, genocide is much more complex and much more subtle than that.
Well, the term was coined during World War II by Raphael Lemkin, who was a Polish jurist. I think 1944 was the date of the publication, which he explained what was meant by it. And he was quite clear that he was distinguishing what it was that was under discussion from simple mass murder, no matter how massive the murder. That concept was already in existence. It was understood that mass killing was wrong. It was a crime. It was a crime against humanity. There was no reason for a new term to describe that. What he was trying to get to with genocide was the intentional eradication of a human group as such, so that the group and the group identity disappeared from human existence.
People could still be there.
That was a point that he made quite clearly. Mass killing is one way to accomplish that, but only one, and not necessarily even the most common one. Okay? And he went so far as to say a genocide could be accomplished, the group driven out of existence, so that it was never known again, even though every individual member of the targeted group survived, continued their individual human existence. No one was killed. But genocide nonetheless could be accomplished. Where you find it reflected in international laws in the 1948 Genocide Convention. Under Article 2, there's the enumeration of five different classifications or categories of official action or policy that can be undertaken to accomplish a genocide. Only the first one pertains to killing, direct killing. 20% of the definition. The other 80% are not directly lethal means.
And these have to do with language, tradition, culture?
Well, these are not elucidated directly. There was considerable amount of discussion of what's now called cultural genocide by the committee, the drafting committee of the Genocide Convention. The United States and Canada combined to drive that out of the draft convention that was later ratified after further discussion by the General Assembly. And then both of them refused to sign it even after they'd gutted it.
The U.S. didn't sign for 40 years. Did Canada sign ever?
Canada signed, I'm not sure the signing date of Canada. It was about 20 years after the fact, so they only balked at it for half as long as the United States. The United States, incidentally, is still not accepted as a signatory because when the Reagan administration finally did submit a tentative ratification, the Senate, Jesse Helms and others, Lugar, mm-hmm. Orrin Hatch, had attached what they called a sovereignty package to it. So we'll sign it, we'll ratify it, but with these exceptions, these provisions, and the provisions are that nothing in this international law can contravene anything in the United States Constitution. So if the Constitution guarantees you something that would be internationally considered as genocidal, you can engage in these activities under the constitutional framework. Even though it's prohibited by international law, you're free to do so in the United States. In effect, they were saying that the United States maintains a position allowing itself or its citizens to engage in genocidal activities at its own discretion. And they were also saying that the Constitution of the United States stands at some level or another higher than international law, which is exactly the argument that was advanced by the Nazi defendants at Nuremberg and struck down by a justice of the Supreme Court, Robert Jackson, and the U.S. Attorney General who was on the tribunal, Francis Biddle. The United States was not accepting of that line of reasoning when it was the Germans making right. the argument, but they advanced the same argument themselves.
I understand what you're saying about the United States placing itself higher than international law, but what in particular might the United States be protecting itself from?
What they call free speech rights. Free speech rights, insofar as they pertain to the incitement of genocide, which a lot of people, the standard interpretation is that mm-hmm. includes advocacy of it. Advocacy is a form of incitement. That's unlawful under Article 3. But the United States is taking the position that, among other things, its citizens have a right to advocate and incite genocide, even though that's illegal under international law. And the United States took a lead role in hanging one of the Nazi defendants for no more than advocacy or incitement to genocide. Right. It was a death penalty. So there's a very great degree of inconsistency there, to put it most politely, double standard or claim to a right to practice genocidal conduct on the part of the United States. It does not want to obey the law. Mm-hmm. By that definition, then, the United States is an outlaw state. It claims an inherent right to act in an illegal fashion when it decides it's in its interest to do so. Mm-hmm. But there's matters of U.S. policy that were also embodied in that. They advance this constitutional principle. So citizens will buy into it, saying that their individual rights, constitutional rights, as if someone had a right to be genocidal, are protected. But I think what was really at issue was that the United States government itself had policies which were clearly genocidal in place and still operate against primarily Native people, but not exclusively so, in 1948. And they continued those policies for the bulk, at least, some instances for the duration of the 40 years they refused to sign.
I think of in the 1940s, I can think of Jim Crow laws in...
Jim Crow laws would go to it, and there was a lot of discussion on that. Would it be genocidal for an individual Klan leader to stand up and argue that five blacks should be killed next week? Just any blacks, mm-hmm. simply because they're black. Now, that's within the definition of incitement. And if Klan people went out and lynched a black simply because the person they encountered was black, not because they thought that specific individual had done anything other than be born black, that too was in the framework of genocide as the law was constructed. They found that a little awkward since the Klan was engaging in lynchings, and there was plenty of advocacy going on. But more formally, the fourth criteria under Article 2 is the forced transfer of children from a targeted group to the targeting group for purposes then of raising them as someone other than who they are.
And adopting out was
adopting
common,
out, blind adoptions of Native children, but I think more importantly from the government's perspective, the whole boarding school process, compulsory attendance at remote boarding schools so that Native children could be systematically raised as individuals who would see the world in some fashion other than as Native individuals, mm-hmm. and for the stated purpose of causing them to become intellectual, psychological non-natives. Okay?
Better.
That's a patent violation of the Genocide Convention.
Right. And the argument was that they would be better American citizens.
And worse natives. Okay?
Yeah.
I think the way Francis Loop, the Indian commissioner who implemented this program on a national basis, put it, the objective was to kill the Indian in each of the children while sparing or saving, I'm not sure of the word, the human being.
The human being.
Yeah.
I want to take a moment to say that this is Ward Churchill with us on this edition of Conversations. His latest books, again, are The Struggle for the Land in 1993, Indians Are Us in 1994, and coming out in the fall of 1995, Since Predator Came. Also Common Courage Press?
That one will be from Aegis.
From Aegis. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. These are two of maybe the three or four kind of greater sins. I'm going to throw this out so you can tell me yes or no and then tell me more. Perpetrated against the Native people since the turn of the 20th century. I'm also thinking of
that would weigh right in there.
Sterilization of Native American women that I understand happened clear up to the 70s, and that was a disturbing news for me.
So nearly as you can tell, it was the late 60s when the programs were implemented by the Indian Health Service, which was at the time lodged administratively under the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And what they did there was in the clinics that they operated as a service to Native people, part of the rent paid for U.S. occupancy of the Native land base. They performed involuntary, unconsenting, unwilling abortions on up to, according to a report released in 1975 by Women of All Red Nations, up to 42% of all the Native women in the United States of childbearing age at that time.
You said abortions. Abortions or sterilizations?
Sterilizations. Did I say abortions?
You did, yeah.
No. Sterilizations. Usually by tubal ligation in instances where they were unknown. Hysterectomies would be the other major mode. Usually the hysterectomies were performed on the basis of false or misleading information were provided to the women to lead them to the conclusion it would be for their best interest or in their best interest to allow the procedure to be performed upon them.
What was the rationale?
Indians have too many children. Indians are a tax drain, okay? The United States does not like to pay rent on property it utilizes, basically.
Now, that feels more like a what you would call an underlying rationale. I'm interested in what might have been in the document that said it was all right, if there was a document.
Well, they really didn't say. There were several documents that went to the rubric of it, but none of them really explained in any clear terms why it was they felt this was necessary. Just that these were people who were impoverished, and you know, the usual conservative saw about, you know, the poorer you are, the more children you proliferate, and the greater the drain you are on your economic, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So they simply engaged in genocide as a means of curtailing practices that they felt were reprehensible. Mm-hmm. Never mind the fact that these people really were destitute only by virtue of the federal government's failure to meet its obligations to provide them with goods and services accruing from their leasing of their land on a long-term basis to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what I mean when I say that the United States does not want to pay rent is that it's on default on its reciprocal relations for occupancy of land base on 371 of 371 ratified treaties in the Kepler compilation of U.S. treaty relations with Indians. The United States does not pay its bills to Indians, and then when the Indians, as a result of not receiving the checks from their tenants, have a little cash shortfall, they blame the Indians for having the cash shortfall. The situation here would be about the same as if the tenant would tell the landlord, I don't want to pay you for living in this apartment this month, and by the way, why don't you go get a job?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pay you anymore, the rent that's due. Go get a job, support yourself. Well, I think by virtue of the prior property ownership and the rental arrangement, that's a pretty standard way of making a living for a lot of non-Indian Americans. There's no expectation that the landlord needs to go get a job in lieu of rent. Anyway, if you think that's a good idea, try out there, those of you who are listening, stop paying your landlord your rent, see what happens to you.
The poverty and social tragedy of many people who are Native Americans today, you say, is a direct heir to everything else that's happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's an integral part of the ongoing process of expropriation of native resources by the United States in order to benefit the United States and what is considered to be the mainstream constituency of the United States at the direct expense of American Indians. And the concomitant of that is native impoverishment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not tragic. Tragedy implies something that's sort of an act of God, unfortunate.
Something,
like a hurricane or an earthquake.
Something we can't
These
help.
Are tragedies, something that cannot be helped.
Let's see.
The situation we're talking about here is something that's a direct consequence of deliberate conscious policy implementation as a crime, not a tragedy. Okay, theft is a crime. Imposition of conditions leading to physical degradation and early death get more into the domain of murder and genocide. That is the context of the U.S. relationship with Native people within its boundaries. And it's a perpetual thing. It's not something that's done abruptly or done through some sort of a sensational process like Auschwitz. It's something that's done on a year-in, year-out, generation-out fashion. Kind of out of sight, out of mind, both in terms of the coverage of it in any sense of accurate portrayal on the one hand, and geographically. Most of the localities in which it occurs are remote from mainstream population centers, so it's not directly noticed by the mainstream. And also out of sight, out of mind, because it is so slow, such a grinding process, and over such a long period of time, that a public that's been conditioned out of sound bites on television, no offense, to have an attention span of about 15 minutes isn't going to notice.
Ward Churchill is our guest on Conversations today. His educational background is thus a master's in communications theory with a cross-cultural focus from Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois. Also from Sangamon, a bachelor's in technological communications, the first in 1974, the second in 1975. In 1992, he was awarded a Doctor of Humane Letters by Alfred University. Ward Churchill has a pretty tremendous number of books to his credit, edited books as well, articles and papers, and not surprisingly, a good number of awards. Among the awards, just a quick look at the last couple of years, he's twice won the Gustavus Myers Award for outstanding books on the subject of intolerance in the United States, the first for The Fantasies of the Master Race, which came out in 1993, and the second for Agents of Repression, a book that came out in 1989. Probably should reverse those. Well, that's all right. The University of Colorado, Ward's employer, has honored him several times for excellence in social service writing in 1992. He's twice won an Outstanding Service and Achievement Award, the first in 1990, or the second in 1990, the first in 1988. He's also been awarded for his promotion of cultural diversity in higher education and another service award in 1987 from the president of the University of Colorado at Boulder. This is Conversations. We're taking a look at how we look at America on this edition of Conversations. Children are seldom adopted out these days. One would hope that no one is sterilized anymore without wanting to be. These are small accomplishments in turning around the impact of 400 years of colonization on an American people. What else do you see as steps to turn this situation around? And where's the energy, where's the power coming from against such a powerful state?
Well, I think in the first instance, I would not be quite as confident as you that these gains have actually been made. In fact, children are still being adopted out. Okay.
The Indian Child Welfare Act was a major attempt to change that.
Some utility to that, but there still is a pronounced and chronic pattern of adopting Indian children out to non-Indians. Okay. You've even got Indians conditioned to see it as in the best interest of the child to be adopted out to non-Indian families as opposed to families available within their own context under a number of rules or standards that have been established by the mainstream society rather than Indians to assess such things. And Indians can be conditioned just like anyone else, but the government's favorite saw is to get an Indian who's been fully conditioned to see things exactly like a non-Indian would see them and say, see, an Indian agrees with us and we're going to go ahead and do what we've been doing anyway with this Indian rubber stamping and signing off for a fee. And that's a practice as old as treaty making. They appointed leaders and bribed them and had them sign on behalf of their people, although they didn't represent anyone. Nothing new in that. The other is, as I understand it, Bill Clinton just nominated an individual to be Surgeon General of the United States, and there were two major lines of objection raised to that individual assuming that position. The first being that he had performed abortions,
right,
and the second being that he had performed involuntary sterilizations on black women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm pro-choice, so I didn't have a great issue with the first. In fact, that was a mark in an individual's favor to me. But the second one gives me pause, because that's exactly what we were talking about in the 1970s, and prior to the disclosures, no one knew that program was happening either. What the dimension of that is a federal program?
Mm-hmm.
I really couldn't say at the present time. But what I can say on that little snapshot reference alone is that it's still occurring. And when we found out about it last time, in more or less its totality, we discovered that they had sterilized very nearly half of all the native women who could bear children at the time. They had done very much the same thing on the island of Puerto Rico to Puerto Rican women, and in selected black communities throughout the rural South in particular, they had been doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They still are. The extent of it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
With regard either to blind adoptions in particular or involuntary sterilizations, I don't know, but I know they're doing both. So I'm not that hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
What would it take to change that? The answer is going to be essentially the United States government must be, by some means or another, held accountable to the rule of law, its own first and foremost, but international law as well. And were that to be accomplished, many of the kinds of things that are at issue in our conversation today and that underlie it or are background to it would be resolved. Just make the United States government law-abiding.
Just.
Law enforcement. It's a law enforcement task. I think Bill Clinton needs yet another 100,000 police just to police himself. They need to be focusing their attention, or the citizens need to be focusing their attention, or both need to be focusing their attention on compelling compliance to the rule of law.
Come back to that word.
The federal government.
Come back to that word just, because you're talking about a massive change and using a word that is way too small for it. What steps, I understand there's a great deal more litigation of Native American issues, treaty issues, as in addition to environmental dumping on Native land or education issues. I don't know how to ask the question I'm trying to ask.
Well, I think you hit the word actually in your last sentence there. It would require a pretty radical transformation of consciousness.
In the nation.
For just about everyone.
Yes.
And Native people included. Native people have been indoctrinated and conditioned to see things other than in terms that their ancestors did. And I'm not talking about spiritual things, and I'm not talking about how to bound around in the bushes like Bambi or any of the rest of the stuff that usually seems to be connoted when you make reference to that. I'm talking about just understanding of their rights and prerogatives as human beings and as nations vis-a-vis this other society. We need a reinsertion of clarity in that regard, but we need a very pronounced insertion. Maybe this is the first insertion of some clarity in that regard with the dominant or non-Indian population as well. We need an educational process that allows these things to be understood and clearly so. Only in understanding can you predicate action that will lead to a kind of a constructive or positive result. So that's the point of departure. That's how you begin to confront this massive totalizing state structure and the illegality of it, because it's intrinsically criminal in the details of performance. And we've been talking about that in certain aspects. The boarding school policy wasn't simply erroneous or misguided. It was criminal. It was illegal. To the extent that there is compulsory attendance at boarding school still directed at Native people, and it's very minor at this point, it's still illegal. But until very recently, the United States was engaged in a systematic violation of international law with regard to nations that are not even recognized as such anymore in any meaningful sense inside its own borders. Mm-hmm. Clearly, systematic sterilization of targeted populations is a crime against humanity. Expropriations of indigenous land and the inversion of indigenous sovereignty, these are both crimes under international law, and they're integral to the function of the federal government. This is not understood clearly, and it's not understood clearly because people are indoctrinated to see it in ways completely the opposite of the reality.
Talk to me about that word integral then.
We can, perhaps for purposes of greatest clarity, take it in a physical sense. Were you to remove the indigenous treaty territories, those areas that are demarcated as being reserved for exclusive use and occupancy of Native nations under the bilateral treaties by which the United States purports to have acquired its legitimate title to that sector of North America which is its own. If you were to remove the Native territories that were reserved in the process of treaty making, right, as a geographical entity, the United States, as it now knows itself, would no longer exist. Okay, according to the Indian Claims Commission, the United States cannot show any kind of a valid title, even a pretense of title, to about 35% of the lower 48 states. That's the Federal Apologist Commission that reaches this conclusion. That's not even counting fraudulent coerced treaties and other things which would be invalid documents under international law. Just sticking with that, to which they can make no claim at all. You see a physical dismemberment of the United States if the law were adhered to. Jurisdictionally, it would be the same result. In terms of the assets profile of the United States, there would be such a radical shift that the United States in general were to conform to law minimum standards of international legal comportment. It simply would not exist geographically, jurisdictionally, in terms of its claimed economy, the nature of its relations with other parties. All of it would be so different as to be unrecognizable. Essentially, the United States would go the route of the Soviet Union at that point. Mm-hmm. You'd be looking around all over and unable to find it, because in the sense that it ever had a meaning, it would not be there anymore. Now, does that mean that, one, you end up with a sort of balkanized situation, such as, at least in the propaganda that comes out, seems to be the prevalent condition in the USSR in the aftermath of a comparable dismemberment of the United States? I'm not sure. I doubt, because the circumstances there and here are dissimilar in many ways, the nature of the relationships, the nature of the people involved in the histories. But what you would see would be the reassertion of a number of nationalities that have been compulsorily or forcibly subsumed under the rubric of the U.S. state structure, reasserting themselves in accordance with different sets of values and understandings and ways of relating to their habitat and one another, in place of this sort of arbitrary structure that's been erected in the name of the United States now. Have I taken you far enough now?
Well, far enough so that I want to ask you a question from the other side, and I mean it with a great deal of respect, but I also know that, and I also know that people listening will be asking this question. Mm-hmm. The United States, the likelihood of the United States breaking apart, as did the former Soviet Union, the likelihood of the United States admitting its crimes and faults and returning what is rightfully native to natives is so small as to not be findable on a map. So here's the bluntest part of it. Why don't you give this up as a bad go? Why not say this is a lost cause?
Well, I think if you were to have 20 years ago sat in a television station in Kiev or Moscow and said, I'm a Ukrainian nationalist or Azerbaijani nationalist, and I don't see a right for the Central Soviet to have this position of dominance over my nation, and my goal is for USSR to be deconstructed, probably you would have gotten a response from the interview very similar to that, or queries from the audience very similar to that. Plus, you would have had the state police come in and take you away to an insane asylum, because only a madman would even suggest this was remotely possible.
Right.
Leonid Brezhnev would have had a belly laugh and gone on with more important business. And the fact of the matter is, 20 years after that statement would have been made, the Soviet Union does not exist, and functionally it has not existed for 5 years.
The Soviet Union wasn't in great shape 20 years ago.
Well, I'd say arguably the United States is not in such great shape either.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you have significant sectors of the population which kind of, for their own reasons and in their own ways, make arguments not all that dissimilar from my own. We're sitting where? Fairbanks, Alaska?
Mm.
Want to call in some libertarian commentators now? We're talking about a complete decentralization there of federal authority and restoration of rights and prerogatives to self-governance at a very localized level. And if that's not something that goes in a general direction of what I'm talking about anyway, I don't know what is. And now we're not talking radical Indians saying that. We're talking fairly conservative white people. So I think there is a lot more sentiment that goes in the direction of a dismemberment of the status structure that I'm critiquing here,
mm-hmm,
than anybody wants to admit. And I think in that, you begin to find a confluence of factors that can lead to a result more proximate to what I'm talking about than not. And I, of course, don't have a crystal ball. I'm unable to prophesy and set out a blueprint for exactly how this would work. I'm simply setting out a sort of hypothesis of what would be required to really resolve a range of problems that we've addressed in here.
Mm-hmm.
Will that happen in 2 years or 20 years or I don't know. But I think we're moving, and I think we have to move in that general direction. I'm talking about native interests in it, but I don't think that the interest in the general dynamic at issue here, or anything that's restricted to Native people. Mm-hmm. I think it's advantageous to everyone that these totalizing state structures be dismembered. It's physically broken up, jurisdictionally broken up, economically broken up, that things be put back in frameworks that are of manageable human scale.
Right, ecologists also argue for this.
Yeah, there's from a lot of different angles, a lot of different groups, maybe even a majority at this point, of people are seeing things one way or another in more or less the same way I'm talking about it.
So as living in America becomes more and more difficult and less fruitful for the general population, that is one opportunity, kind of the USSR opportunity for this change to happen. And the other you talked about earlier, and I wanted to bring you back to it, I think was kind of a large-scale education of the whole population to what the reality is from the Indian perspective.
Well, I think we need some education in the United States. We need a lot less indoctrination. We don't have an education system. We have an indoctrination system. People are fed information, which they're supposed to regurgitate certain amounts for midterm and final exams, punch their ticket, do the rote memorization that goes into that, and go on. Now, it's a stimulus response. Later in life, supposedly, you'll be able to hit the button, and they will give you a pre-programmed answer to it. They never had occasion, nor were they required, to think about what it was they were responding, whether it made sense. They were simply to memorize it.
Right.
This isn't an educational process. They teach you what to think in school, from kindergarten through the PhD. They teach you what to think. They never teach you how to think. In fact, actual thinking, that skill of how to think, to critically analyze, is something that you're not supposed to have, because thinking, actual thought, is a subversive activity in the United States.
Is it your opinion that the introduction of cultural diversity and courses which teach about the diverse culture, at least at the university level, is helping to introduce critical thinking skills?
At least to the extent that you have to take a proposition, examine it from several different angles, whether it really makes sense. But in simply having it handed to you, okay, here's the question, here's the answer, put those two together, get them in your mind so that you can fill in the blank when it comes up in your test and get on with your life.
Right. Three paragraphs on the African-American view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three paragraphs in the African-American view, and then the rest of it is the sort of establishment view of what the appropriate answer is to everything that comes along. It's sort of a little catechism, only it's a 14-year catechism, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's indoctrination. I say that again. I want to keep saying that.
Right.
We have a public indoctrination system that's very well perfected in this country. And what we need is some education. It's a nice place to open a school, and I hope they do so soon. Okay. Good place.
Yeah.
We should have a university here.
Mm.
And to a certain extent, I think we probably do, but that extent, that little beachhead where you begin to have some critical inquiry as to the plausibility of the answers that have been given, that needs to be expanded to where it encompasses the entirety of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
Where a thesis as to what the explanation of certain phenomena is posited early in a course, and you spend the rest of the course analyzing it, subjecting it to critical inquiry to determine whether the thesis, explanatory thesis, is adequate or whether it makes any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ward Churchill is with us on Conversations. We've got about 5 minutes left in our time together. Too short, I think, but I do want to take just a minute or two to tell you more about Ward. If you haven't noted the book titles yet, Indians Are Us, 1994, Since Predator Came, coming out probably in the fall of 1995. I forgot the press. Tell me again.
Aegis Press.
Aegis. Sorry. Thank you. A Struggle for the Land in 1993. Before that, one of his award-winning books was Fantasies of the Master Race, Literature, Cinema, and the Colonization of American Indians. You'll find some of that in Indians Are Us, but it's more the basis of Fantasies of the Master Race. That's from 1992. Ward's also done considerable work investigating the FBI and its secret wars against the Black Panther Party and against domestic dissent and against the American Indian movement. That information came out in two books, The COINTELPRO Papers in 1990 from South End, written with Jim VanderWaal, and also with Jim VanderWaal, Agents of Repression, the FBI's Secret War. Also from South End Press, also 1990. Is there, I suppose what I want to leave this audience with is some sense of what you believe needs to happen to make an America that is livable for its people. I'm interested that you said that the fabric needs to shake in the country, and that education, and especially education and critical thinking, is necessary. This latter speaks to an actual democracy at some point. Is there a third thing or another thing that you think is also important that must happen, that you'd like to leave in the minds of our listeners?
The direct integration of the two, what Antonio Gramsci called organic intellectualism at one point, where you take this process of inquiry and analysis and understanding that is achieved by it, countervailing explanations of how and why things work, take them directly back into the communities so that they can inform the processes by which communities assert their rights, their self-determining capacity. So that there's not a distinction drawn between academia on one hand and this shaking, as you're talking about it, this activism or whatever, on the other.
Right.
That the communities and the intellectuals that derive from the communities are part of a given whole again. And it's been a very long time in this country since that was the case.
This country gets real nervous about intellectuals in grocery stores.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But we need to have actual educational processes as readily available to the general population as the National Enquirer is now. And when that happens, I think you're going to see a marked shift in the way people approach the living of their lives. Mm-hmm. Not because the intellectuals are any smarter, it's just because intellectuals devote themselves to understanding a range of issues that are of use in exactly the same way mechanics devote themselves to understanding how to fix a carburetor. Both have a direct utility to the community, but the mechanic is integrated. Mm-hmm. And the intellectual has been detached. We need to end that.
Boyd Churchill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been Conversations. You have the books, and this has been An Hour with the Man. Thank you very much to Boyd Churchill for spending an hour. I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. I hope you join me again next week. Thank you.